On the show today, a look ahead to the UN General Assembly.
While focusing on Ukraine, Biden must also acknowledge the concerns of the Global South, including the climate crisis, poverty and the plight of refugees, inflation, and debt reduction.
Plus, VOA visits the mountains of Morocco.
Now, some international rescue workers are leaving, like Swedish firefighter Klas Ola Kolberg.
We have tried to work with the dogs to search for living persons, and so far we haven't found anyone.
And later, an icon of music journalism and the 60s counterculture finds himself cancelled. And coffee farmers in Kenya appear to have found a more profitable use for their land. Today is Monday, September 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA's headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. President Joe Biden's domestic agenda coming up next. First, though, a look ahead at global politics. With the UN General Assembly in New York set to begin on Monday, Biden will attempt to strengthen international support for Ukraine, while many countries in the Global South seek to draw attention toward development challenges and other international crises. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this preview.
Fresh off his historic visit to Vietnam and the G20 summit in India, U.S. President Joe Biden will again engage with world leaders, this time at the United Nations General Assembly in New York. He is expected to rally support for Ukraine as he did last year.
This war is about extinguishing Ukraine's right to exist as a state, plain and simple, and Ukraine's right to exist as a people.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky plans to attend in person to rally support for his country. He will meet Biden at the White House Thursday. While focusing on Ukraine, Biden must also acknowledge the concerns of the Global South, including the climate crisis, poverty and the plight of refugees, inflation and debt reduction.
These are connected because the war, Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine, has caused ripple effects that impact food security, energy security and other forms of harm to countries around the world. And so ending this war on just terms, on the principles of sovereignty and territorial integrity, would serve the benefit not just of the Ukrainian people, but people everywhere.
Not to be outdone by Chinese leader Xi Jinping, who met with Central Asian leaders earlier this year, Biden is also scheduled to summit with the heads of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield.
We don't see this as competing with China for influence with these countries. We see it as building on a relationship that we already have.
Biden will hold bilateral meetings on the sidelines of UNGA, including with next G20 chair Brazilian President Lula da Silva, and with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. has expressed disapproval of the Netanyahu government's hardline policies, including its judicial overhaul plan, which critics say is a danger to Israel's democracy. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Back at home, President Biden says that he's focused on the things American people want and not political theater. This follows a week in which the House of Representatives opened an impeachment inquiry into allegations that he had benefited from his son Hunter's foreign business dealings. All this comes as lawmakers must strike a deal with Biden to keep the government open past a September 30th funding deadline. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has the story.
U.S. President Joe Biden attended church in his home state of Delaware just days after Republicans in the House of Representatives opened an impeachment inquiry citing an alleged pattern of corruption. The White House calls it a political stunt. This past week, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy addressed the media outside his office at the United States Capitol.
House Republicans have uncovered serious and credible allegations into President Biden's conduct. Taken together, these allegations paint a picture of a culture of corruption.
McCarthy went on to describe the allegations as an abuse of power, obstruction, and corruption that warrant further investigation by the House of Representatives. Democrats say this is pandering partisan politics at its worst. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week.
The White House has cooperated, and I believe the White House will continue to cooperate because there is nothing to hide. There is no facts in the record to suggest that President Biden engaged in wrongdoing. There are no facts on the record to suggest that President Biden engaged in impeachable offenses. There are no facts on the record to suggest that President Biden broke the law in any way, shape, or form. This is an illegitimate impeachment inquiry.
Republicans say they want more information related to the allegations. Republican Nancy Mace speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week.
The facts are everywhere. There are text messages. There are emails. There are witnesses. There are whistleblowers. There are meetings. There are phone calls. There are dinners. And you can't say, hey, there's a little bit of smoke. We're not going to follow the fire.
Former President Donald Trump, the current Republican frontrunner for the presidency himself, facing more than 40 felony counts in multiple court cases, says he supports a government shutdown if House Republicans don't get what he called a fair deal on a short-term spending bill. The details of such a fair deal remain unclear. Biden and McCarthy's futures are intertwined in this impeachment inquiry. After issuing one, the full House votes on whether the president should be impeached, triggering a trial in the Senate if the vote is yes. Meanwhile, the House has just a handful of working days in session to pass a short-term continuing resolution or risk a government shutdown. Some conservative Republicans are demanding spending cuts lower than what Speaker McCarthy agreed to in a budget deal with Biden earlier this year. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
People whose homes were swept away by flooding in Libya's eastern city of Derna a week ago faced the dilemma on Sunday of whether to stay despite a lack of fresh water or flee through areas where landmines have now been displaced. Reuters' Fiona Jones has more.
Survivors whose houses were swept away by the devastating flood in Libya's city Derna have a hard choice to make. Stay despite a lack of fresh water, or flee through areas where landmines have been displaced by the torrents. This Derna resident, Hamad Awad, sat on a blanket on an empty street with a bottle of water and bedding alongside him. He said he is staying to clean up the area. Another resident, Wasfi, said people were at a loss over what to do next. Thousands of people are feared to have died after two dams above Derna broke on September the 10th. Obliterating residential blocks while people slept. Many bodies were washed out to sea and more than 1,000 have already been buried in mass graves, according to the United Nations. A week on, Libyan rescue volunteers confront the devastation, describing the scene as tragic. Entire districts of Derna, with an estimated population of at least 120,000, were swept away or buried in mud. State media said on Sunday at least 891 buildings had been destroyed in the city, whose mayor has said 20,000 people may have died. On Saturday, the UN Libya envoy visited the flood-stricken Derna, where he checked up on field operations and met the head of the Eastern-based administration. A report by the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said Libyan authorities had detected at least 55 children poisoned from drinking polluted water in Derna, where the homeless were surviving in makeshift shelters, schools, or packed into the houses of relatives or friends. It said floodwaters had shifted landmines and other ordnance left over from years of conflict, posing an extra risk to the thousands of displaced people on the move.
That's Fiona Jones of Reuters reporting for us today. And here are other stories we're following from around the world. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen on Sunday visited the Italian island of Lampedusa, which is struggling with a surge in migrant arrivals. She promised a 10-point EU action plan to help Italy deal with the situation. Russia targeted Ukraine's Odessa region early on Sunday with a combined drone and missile attack, hitting an agricultural facility. The extent of the damage there was not immediately clear. Also Sunday, Ukraine launched drone attacks on Moscow and Crimea, where an official said that a drone had hit a fuel tank, causing a fire. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi in Malta this weekend, according to announcements from Beijing and Washington on Sunday. Sullivan's meeting with Wang was the latest in a series of high-level discussions between U.S. and Chinese officials that could lay the groundwork for a meeting between U.S. President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping later this year. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists, using data from NASA's Curiosity rover, found the first evidence of wet-dry cycling on Mars. One of many theories leading to the origin of life on Earth is based on something called wet-dry cycling. This implies that a continual series of wet and dry ground conditions on our planet helped create the necessary chemical building blocks for bacterial life. Curiosity found an assortment of hexagonal patterns of well-kept ancient mud cracks, providing another clue that the Red Planet may have hosted microbial life early in its history. The lead author of a study detailing these findings is William Rapin of France's Research Institute in Astrophysics and Planetology. He said in a NASA press release that these newfound mud cracks are made when wet-dry conditions repeatedly occur, perhaps seasonally. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From Washington, it's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. We meet a persecuted Iranian journalist in a few minutes. Now, families in Morocco's High Atlas Mountains are still burying their dead, a week after a 6.8 magnitude earthquake killed at least 2,900 people. Hopes of finding survivors under the rubble are fading, though leaving the looming problem of rebuilding homes and lives. Lisa Bryant is there.
If there's a bright spot after this earthquake, it's the kindness of strangers. Moroccans donating truckloads of clothes and other basics to survivors. Fatma El Makra and her family are among those survivors. Like many others, they lost everything. She says about 20 people died in her village, including a neighbor hit by a rock as he tried to save his wife. She says when the disaster happened, they left everything behind and ran for their lives. Driving here is frightening. Steep cliffs, rock slides potentially triggered by aftershocks. One reason why aid was slow to get here. Now some international rescue workers are leaving, like Swedish firefighter Klaus Ola Kohlberg.
We have tried to work with the dogs to search for living persons, and so far we haven't found anyone.
Many still alive are now homeless, like the family of Naima Azmil, who are having tea this morning. She says right now they have food, clothes, and shelter, but they're living day by day. They don't know about the future. That's a feeling here shared by many. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Emin Sili, Morocco.
The story of a famous and highly influential music journalist who said some pretty terrible things and is paying the price, coming up next. Now, the story of an Iranian journalist working in the face of bigotry and threats of violence. Iran is an already oppressive environment for media that has grown worse since mass protests sprouted up across the country last year. Female reporters and those from marginalized communities face even greater threats. Carmela Caruso has produced this story, narrated today by Jessica Jarit.
Being a journalist in Iran is rarely easy. But for female reporters or those from marginalized communities, the risk is twofold. Take Azal Abbasian, who identifies as non-binary. Abbasian faces regular questioning and harassment from Iranian authorities. Even family members were harassed over Abbasian's coverage, leading the journalist to eventually flee Iran and now work as a freelancer for international media outlets. Abbasian told VOA via email that Iran's society is extremely homophobic, and me, as an LGBTQI journalist and feminist, even got death threats via social media from Islamic Republic's cyber army. Kiran Nazish, founding director of the Coalition for Women in Journalism, says online campaigns are a serious threat for journalists in Iran and those who go into exile.
There are a lot of Iranian journalists, bloggers, analysts, human rights defenders, lawyers, attorneys who have been speaking, feminists who had been speaking more last year, but we saw a very effective, you know, online smear campaigns against these journalists.
The threat of arrest and online harassment has only increased since the mass protests in 2022 over the death of a young Kurdish woman in police custody. Iran's mission to the United Nations did not respond to VOA's request for comment. Abbasian has kept a close eye on the protests in Iran, The journalist's collarbone is tattooed with a message, "Women, Life, Freedom," in a show of solidarity with the dozens of journalists who have been arrested. Abbasian told VOA, "I want the international community to know that Women, Life, Freedom is still active. It's not just a protest against compulsory hijab. It's about citizens' rebellion against Islamic Republic and all their cruelty." Also watching the protest movement closely is Afra Ahmed, who fled Iran for Turkey. Ahmed, who writes under a pen name, says she faced persecution for being a member of the Baha'i community, a religious minority in Iran that has been targeted by the regime. As a female journalist and Baha'i, Ahmed said that she too has faced plenty of challenges.
It's like, when you're a woman, you're a second degree citizen. When you're a Baha'i, you're a second degree citizen. When you're a journalist, you're not even a citizen.
But from the relative safety of exile, she's been able to connect with other journalists and help get information out about what is happening in her home country at a time when dozens of reporters remain behind bars for covering the protest movement. For Camilla Caruso, Jessica Dreet, VOA News.
Rolling Stone magazine co-founder Jan Wenner has been removed from the board of directors of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame after controversial comments about black and female musicians. AP's entertainment correspondent Margie Zaraletta reports.
Jan Wenner's new book, The Masters, features interviews he did with musicians who all happen to be male and white. When the New York Times asked him last week why he did not include women or black musicians, he said Joni Mitchell, for example, was not a philosopher of rock and roll and did not meet his test as a master. He said maybe Marvin Gaye or Curtis Mayfield could be a master, but he said they just didn't articulate at that level. He said for public relations sake, maybe he should have found one black and one woman to include just to avert criticism. Wenner has since apologized. The Rock Hall, which Wenner co-founded, says Wenner is no longer on the board of directors.
That's Margie Zaraletta reporting. Some American auto workers are still out on strike. As Shelley Adler reports, salary is one of the main sticking points in the negotiations.
The big argument for the UAW, if Detroit's three automakers raise CEO pay by some 40% over the past 4 years, workers should get similar raises. And Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna of California agrees.
When you have Mary Barra making $30 million, when you have $5 billion in stock buybacks, when you have these big three auto companies making $21 billion, we can pay auto workers more than $16 and they can have good paying jobs. And that's what this fight is about.
Khanna appeared on Fox News Sunday. The walkout began at midnight Friday. I'm Shelley Adler.
If you're one of the millions of people around the globe who just doesn't feel ready to face the world until they've had their morning cup of coffee, this next story might shake you up. Even though the International Coffee Organization says Kenya is the fifth largest coffee producer in Africa, Kenya's coffee farmers are being increasingly squeezed by climate change, price fluctuations, and now a real estate boom. Francis Ontomo reports from Kenya's capital, Nairobi.
This is Kiambu area, nestled south of Nairobi, a cornerstone of Kenya's coffee industry. But with massive harvests from India and Indonesia flooding the market, prices are down, and some farmers are getting out of the business of farming and becoming landlords instead. Modern houses now stand where coffee bushes once thrived, and farmers like 57-year-old Joseph Ndongo believe it's the only rational choice to survive in today's economy.
Coffee is now being overtaken by the real estate because, one, real estate has a good earning. You are getting this money every month. In a coffee, you get it. This is a perennial crop. You'll get it once in a year. So you see real estate is more better than doing coffee or tea.
Just a few years ago, these lands were covered in thriving coffee plantations. Now, towering apartment buildings have taken their place, with billboards advertising land for sale at every turn. Stephen Njoroge chairs a local farmer's factory, but contemplates his exit from coffee farming. He says they're not being paid commensurate to their efforts as farmers. He says he invests so much in planting, harvesting, and uses his own capital, but at the end of the day, he doesn't get anything out of it. He says it's frustrating. Most local farmers' cooperative societies are in disarray, like the Gathwirini factory, which serves over 700 farmers. Coffee beans sit in sacks collected from farmers several weeks ago, but have yet to be collected by the millers for processing, says Samuel Masharia.
cooperatives are dying out of loans because there are so much loans that were taken when coffee was a big business. And now that the production has gone down, cooperatives are finding it difficult to meet and pay these loans.
Some economists like Vincent Kimosop say the cooperatives need better leadership and government support.
Address the governance issues in those areas so that those who are practicing in the space could actually gain and benefit from such a practice, because demand for coffee is still there. And you can see there are countries that have gotten it right, like in the Latin Americas, that are able to reap foreign exchange, employment creation, and they contribute significantly to their economies.
The Kenyan government says coffee production in the country has plummeted from about 130,000 metric tons annually in the 1980s to only 50,000 metric tons in 2022. Francis Ontomwa for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the Africa Food Systems Forum 2023, USAID Deputy Administrator Isabel Coleman noted that since 2010, Feed the Future investments have unlocked close to $5 billion in agricultural financing, leveraged more than $2.5 billion private sector investment in food security, and generated more than $18 billion in sales for smallholder farmers. Small and medium enterprises, or SMEs, are the backbone of African food systems. Together, they are the largest employer in Africa and the key to spurring economic growth and transforming subsistence agriculture into a more productive, resilient sector, said Deputy Administrator Coleman.
Yet fully 75% of African SMEs do not have access to formal bank finance. The financing gap is particularly acute for women, despite growing evidence that closing gender gaps in agriculture is a critical pathway to ending global hunger.
It is critical to reset the incentive structure for financing agribusiness across the continent, said Deputy Administrator Coleman. The Deal Room, a U.S.-sponsored program that facilitates partnerships and investments in African agriculture, can help do that.
It provides companies with the opportunity to access finance, mentorship, and market entry solutions to support their growth objectives. It also creates opportunities for governments to present investment opportunities, create incentives, and engage with interested investors. Since 2018, over $2 billion worth of financial transactions have been negotiated among 600 enterprises and 110 investors through the Deal Room.
Origin Fresh is one example of how the Deal Room model has created opportunities for women-owned businesses. With $7 million in financing facilitated by the Deal Room, Origin Fresh has grown to support more than 50,000 small-scale farmers, purchasing fruits and nuts to produce and export quality oils around the world. In an effort to increase investment in small and medium-sized agricultural enterprises, Deputy Administrator Coleman announced a $4 million grant for Africa's first women in agribusiness digital marketplace called Value for Her. Agribusinesses across Africa are ready and able to absorb more financing, said Deputy Administrator Coleman.
But others must join, as we've done with Feed the Future, and adapt to the changing needs of the industry, boost engagement with small and medium enterprises, including the local formal financial sector, direct more resources to women-led organizations, and above all, listen to the voices of local actors.
African food systems are poised for transformation, said Deputy Administrator Coleman. And I look forward to seeing many more exciting achievements.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.